Good evening and welcome to the Solari Report. This evening is Thursday, January 14th, 2010. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join us this evening. Tonight is a big one. We've got our outlook for precious metals for 2010 with Franklin Sanders, and for part of the time we're going to be discussing some of the newest administration policy proposals regarding changes to 401ks and IRAs, what that means to us and what it means to the precious metals markets. First, I'm going to review the top stories in money and markets, and then some questions and ask Catherine. And then in Let's Go to the Movies, we're going to be discussing Shut Up and Sing, the documentary on the Dixie Chicks. Our theme for tonight, and it's going to be a theme that comes up again and again this year, is rush hour cometh. And what I mean by rush hour cometh is for literally for generations, we have dealt with the issues of resource allocation globally by printing more paper. We've printed treasury securities. We've printed fiat currency. And now we're coming into the end game of that process where we have far more paper than we have real things. We have far more pension fund and other obligations than we have real funding to back it. And so now, you know, rush hour is a time when everybody has to funnel through a really small space. And we are watching in all the news this week real serious debate, discussion, squabbling, if you will, about who's going to pay and who's going to take liability for the debt. So in Iceland, we're watching the referendums grow against the citizens having to be responsible for the foreigners' debt that went bust with the banks. In California and throughout the state and local government, how are we going to carry the debt and pay for expenses? So big budget woes. Lots of rumors and talk about whether Japan is going to be able to maintain and pay their debt. And so the sovereign debt crisis grows at both the country level, the state and local level. But as that happens, you're starting to see greater tensions between those who've got money and resources and those who need it and want it and how they're going to get it. So we see growing tension with China that has significant trillions, literally, that are including those invested in the federal budget. We see the announcement, if you look now at the Federal Reserve balance sheet, during 2009, the Federal Reserve grew its securities holdings from $500 billion to almost $2 trillion. So serious implication that the Federal Reserve in the last year literally financed the mortgage and the treasury markets. And in the United States, the question is, who's going to finance the deficit this year? Is it going to be the Chinese, or is it going to come out of American pension fund? We saw the policy sort of a trial balloon by the administration on providing literally a mandatory, and it's called, I can't even pronounce it, it's turning withdrawals from 401ks into IRAs into annuities. One of the people at the Department of Treasury who's floating the trial balloon comes from Brookings, where they also have written proposals, the Hamilton Project at Brookings, saying that now all businesses, all employers should be mandated to provide an option for employees to have the equivalent of a 401k. It's really going to be through an IRA mechanism. But we're watching more and more trial balloons looking to force or encourage not only more savings by Americans, but having those savings channel into something that's going to help finance the budget and the deficit. Now, not surprisingly, as this happens, you're seeing more and more squabbling worldwide about who exactly is going to hold the position of who controls and runs the Treasury in a country, who controls and runs the Federal Reserve. So here in the United States, we've seen squabbles about whether Bernanke is going to be reappointed. One of the biggest stories this week was the continuing troubles by the Secretary of the Treasury over the AIG deal, in which AIG, thanks to the Treasury and the Federal Reserve, made good on swaps, including to Goldman Sachs, the result being that Goldman Sachs literally got a $10 billion gift not a loan, not a bailout, a gift. And we've watched as various reporters and various people in Congress have tried to dig out and get the information on what has happened. What came out recently was emails from the New York Fed indicated that the New York Fed had ordered AIG to not disclose certain aspects of the deal, essentially in violation of securities law. AIG went ahead and disclosed it. More came out. Now we have Congress subpoenaing the emails, the White House saying that Geithner is the president of the New York Fed was not involved. It was the lower downs. But meantime, we have Bloomberg, the Bloomberg lawsuit against the Fed to get Freedom of Information Act information continues, and the Fed basically filing a motion in federal court saying we can't afford to give this information out. Geithner is on record, or the Treasury is on record, as saying that they had proposed to Goldman a deal where they got less than 100% of the swap value, so less than 10%. We see in testimony before the new finance commission set up by Congress and the administration, we see the chairman of Goldman Sachs saying they were never offered that deal. Now, this is a very interesting development this week because one of them is lying. But what is all of this about? It's about squabbles about who's going to control those positions when the decisions get made of whether we try and force the Chinese to finance the deficit, whether the Federal Reserve finances the deficit for another year, or whether we force the American people in their retirement savings to finance the debt. But no matter which way you look at what's happening, the real question is we can't solve these problems anymore with funny money. Now we're going to have to solve them with real money, and now that's going to force many, many years of conversations about how are we going to change, because we can't continue to be as wasteful as we can now. We've talked many times over the last year about how this is going to play out at state and local government, but we're watching a very interesting conversation go on as the health care reform goes to Congress. We had the Arizona governor. The governors are giving their state of the state addresses. The president, of course, later this month will give his state of the union. The Arizona government came out in her state of the state, I put it up on the blog, and talked about the fact that one of the reasons they're having such terrible problems with their budget is all the federal mandates, and they literally can't afford them. She then speaks about how the new health care bill and the expenses it will force on the state and the mandates it will force on the state, and describes the fact that there are now 14 state attorney generals who are researching how to protest and stop this, again, at what's called a 10th Amendment issue. If you haven't read the Constitution and the 10th Amendment, I strongly recommend it to you. It's great background for what's going to be happening this year. And she proceeds to say in her state of the state that if the Arizona Attorney General will not join with those other 14 attorney generals, she will. Now, these are very strong words for a governor. And so it's really something to watch, because as now we need real money and not bubble money to pay for these things, you know, the politics on this thing are really going to change. A couple other stories I just wanted to note quickly. One is I put up on the blog two health stories. Significant health risks increase from watching TV. You all know how I feel about TV, so I wanted to make sure you got that. As a recent study came out and got fairly well publicized, another one on genetically modified corn, which finds its way into our food system, not just because corn is in so many things, but because corn syrup is. And if corn syrup is not, corn is used to feed animals. So corn, a surprising amount of genetically modified corn makes its way into our meat supply. The report indicates that genetically modified corn damages organs, particularly the liver and kidney, which are the detoxifying organs. That's up on the blog, and I recommend both to you. Finally, something we're going to talk a lot more about in later Solari reports, and that is the government is planning on hiring over 1 million temporary workers to as census workers to collect information on all of us. I bring that up. There's a wonderful article in Nexus Magazine called Identity Cards, A Global Perspective, talking about the dangers of creating, basically control systems using these kinds of databases. If you haven't read Edwin Black's book on IBM and the Holocaust, it's another one I recommend to you. What Black describes in his book is before you could have a Holocaust, or before you could really have a fascist government, you had to have a system whereby you collected data on everyone. And so data collection is step number one. And if you look at the process that's expected, it's going to be quite invasive. So we're going to talk about that more. But over 1 million temporary workers hired essentially to go door to door to collect data on all of us. So lots happening in the money markets this week. Obviously a very big earthquake in Haiti. And so I would just, as I've done on the blog, ask for prayers for all the people of Haiti. Okay, Ask Catherine. We've had a fair amount of questions. Thank you again for your questions. One from the wrap-up last week, I spoke about the fact that I thought one of the big risks this year was going to be climate change. Somebody wrote in and said, oh, my God, you don't believe all that Al Gore stuff. And I just wanted to confirm, no, I'm not concerned about what is often described as global warming. I am concerned that we're dealing with very stressful weather. And I've tried, like all of us, to understand why. You know, is it solar weather? Is it space weather? Is it man-made weather control? And I just have to say that the information is not available to us enough to really have a real working hypothesis of what's causing the weather change. But I do know it's happening, and I do know it's making the world very tough for farmers, whether it's droughts or, as we had in Tennessee, too much water. And so it's when you look at the food supply and the economy, this kind of stressful weather is a real issue, and I think we're going to be dealing with it all year long. A second question, a very tough one, are chemtrails killing my family? For the last month, they have chemtrailed almost daily in San Diego. Are my kids safe? No one ever covers it. What is in those chemtrails? I've put it up on the blog, and I've mentioned it before, but I'll mention it again. There's a wonderful documentary on chemtrails, Aerosol Crimes. It's up on YouTube. If you just do a search, you can find it. I'll put it up again on the blog sometime next week. And then there is a reporter named Will Thomas who covers chemtrails, and I would watch Aerosol Crimes, and I would do a search on Will Thomas. You can pick up his website. And they've done a lot of work of trying to figure out what's in it and what the health effects are. The last 5 or 10 minutes of Aerosol Crimes I think she's a nutritionist or nurse, who just describes all the steps you can take to protect yourself from what appears to be the things in chemtrails which are toxic for humans. We've been getting a great question that's now the number one in the polls, that basically says, I'm a super nerd and I'm comfortable doing a lot with people. What can I do? And I just wanted to let you know that I'm planning at a later date to really address that. We have an article called Coming Clean, so I'm going to do something called Coming Clean for Super Nerds. And so that's coming down the line, and I just want you to know I'm focused on that question. I'm going to address it. We also got a great one saying, what is your top 10 book list for navigating the new decade and supporting paradigm shift? And that's one I'm working on as well. Water rights versus small farmers, a very good question about is it safe to contemplate starting a small farm because of the danger of water rights being taken away or diverted. That's a very legitimate question, and I think water rights are going to be one of the very big issues at the heart of the 10th Amendment issues. So if I were you, I would recommend, if you are contemplating starting a small farm, I would be very careful to do it in a state and a local jurisdiction where you have tremendous support to defend property rights from federal encroachment, because that's where you're going to get both federal encroachment and corporate encroachment, but they're related. So great questions in Ask Catherine, and I'm going to defer the rest to our precious metals outlook with Franklin Sanders. Franklin, are you with us?
I'm right here.
Okay, well, we've just had a lively discussion. So you have been charting. I feel like you've been immersed in the, you know, in the inner sanctum doing these amazing charts. But you've been in the inner sanctum looking at what's happened last year and kind of noodling about what's happening next year. So why don't you give us your recap? How have we done over the last year? Were we right to do precious metals?
Well, here were the returns. Gold went from 906.70 to 1095.20, which is a 20.8% return. Silver was up 35.6%. The Dow was up 18%, nearly 19%. But the big winners this year, believe it or not, were quirky platinum and palladium. Platinum was up 57% and palladium was up 118%. And that just goes to show that you can't be at every party at the same time. the problem with platinum and palladium is that both the supply and the demand is very, very quirky. If I had looked at platinum at the beginning of last year, I would have said no thank you, because a great amount of the platinum demand and the palladium demand goes into automobile catalytic converters. And so, you know, who would have said that they would, either one of them would rise in the face of a very difficult year for automobile manufacturers? But they did.
So, can they recycle them out of the clunkers?
They do recycle. There's a tremendous recycling industry, but that should have put downward pressure on the,
right.
on the market.
Oh, right.
But apparently there are a lot of people who look at those as strategic metals, and I don't really focus on them because they're just very, very quirky. The supply, 75% of the supply of platinum, 75% of the supply of palladium come from areas of the world where a lot of the decisions are made politically, either from the southern part of Africa or from Russia. And it's just too difficult. It's too risky for me compared to the plain hedging of dollar risk.
Well, although, you know, it's interesting when you think about it that what you're saying is in something that's that controlled by so few decision makers, they become hostage of economic warfare, and so the price can be all over the place.
Exactly.
But that's what's happening to the rest of the economy.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. The one thing I left out is that the U.S. dollar index finished the year down 5.5%, even though it experienced a very big, rally and peak in the first quarter of the year in March. One of the things that's interesting is if you look across the board, you see that the idea that silver and gold are just the mirror image of the dollar has been repudiated, and what we see is the dollar goes down 5%, gold rises 20.8%, silver rises 35.6%. What that says to me is that they have decoupled from the dollar. The forces that are driving people out of the dollar and into silver and gold are basically forces of preservation, and you're seeing the buildup of a gigantic move as more and more people flee from the dollar and the risk that the dollar represents. So if you look at this last year, it's very, very interesting to me that you've got a peak in the dollar toward the end of March, and yet in the first quarter of the year, gold and silver both made bottoms in roughly mid January, and then 35 days later they made huge peaks. So the fact that the dollar was in the middle of a screaming rally did not slow down silver and gold at all.
Well, when I look at that chart, what I think is, you know, that's the chart of that of something which is experiencing very broad-based, long-term strategic accumulation.
Right.
A lot of people are buying, and they're buying steadily.
Right, and if you look, you know, I went back and looked at the closings of the year, which is just the 31 December close, and compared that for the period since gold has been in a bull market, which is 2001 forward, and what you see is if you average all those gains out, there's a 17% gain year on year since 2001 in gold, and a roughly 20% gain in silver since 2002. So that's the definition of a primary uptrend. And so this confirms what we've been saying, that we're in a primary uptrend, a bull market in silver and gold. And if you look, gold since 2001 has gained 293%. Silver's gained 267%. Actually, in the, by today's close, it's gained 308%. And at the same time, stocks have gone down 76%.
Right.
So versus gold. So that confirms what we've said about our fundamental strategy for protecting ourselves against what the federal government is doing to the money supply.
Right, and clearly this is truly a global phenomenon because if you look at who's using it to protect themselves, it's people all over the world.
Right.
It's far from just us in North America. This is a global phenomenon.
Right. I think one of the things that you have to remember, though, is that in the last year, both silver and gold ran up in a kind of a bubble phase. I hate to use the word bubble because it gives people terminal ideas, and I'm not talking about terminal. It's just markets go up and they go down. They zigzag up,
right,
and they get overbought and then they get oversold. And so you saw that peak in December in both silver and gold, and now they've probably completed a correction. The markets, those two markets look vastly different than the stock market. Stocks gained from March of last year. If you look at the Dow, they went from about 6,550 to about 10,700 today. That looks wonderful, doesn't it? Until you look at the chart. And when you look at the chart, what you see is a very, very bearish formation called a rising wedge. And they are reaching the end. The stocks are reaching the end of that wedge. They'll probably spike through the top of the trend line. The Dow, for instance, probably go to 11,000 or so, and then they'll come down very sharply. So you have to expect that. It's a very large market. Stocks are a very large market, so it takes them a long time to turn. But you have to expect a very, very sharp drop sometime beginning, if not in the second quarter of this year, then at least in the second half of this year.
I think that the thing that's been unnerving, sort of many of the people in the institutional market, is if you look at the statistics on who's buying, whether it's treasury, in the treasury market or the mortgage market, but even in the stock market, it's what I call, how I rant on about the missing money. Well, now we have the missing investor.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, there are no investors buying, so who's buying?
Well, there's a good question.
Right.
It's the same question. If you watch daily the dollar index, you have to say to yourself, well, who in the world is buying it? The patterns that are, as I explained to you earlier, the patterns that are traced out look like, for instance, this week, there were 3 days that it looked like a reversal, and every day was followed by lower prices. So that's a very unusual pattern. It looks like, not to be too conspiratorial, but it looks like...
But the profits of the major investment banks would indicate...
Right. That somebody is coming in there and supporting the market.
Right.
And I think I ought to say about the dollar, the dollar is trying to rally. The dollar went through, 8 months of downward movement last year, and it apparently has begun to rally, but it's having a very, very slow time of it. The dollar turns slowly anyway, so that's not too surprising. We ought to see a rally in the first half of this year up to, on the dollar index, say 83, and it's about 76.80 today. So that'll give you an idea. That puts a headwind, not an impossible headwind, but it certainly will slow down gold and silver. The biggest surprise that might come this year would be a big rally in the market, say a rally up in the area of 90 on the dollar index. That's a possibility. From here, it doesn't look like a liability, technically. Doesn't look
but
like a liability.
But how do we get that kind of rally and finance the deficit without a major war?
Well, you know, what Bernanke has done, Bernanke is like, I hope you've never had the misfortune to be in an automobile driving with a drunk at the wheel. But if you have, you know what it's like to have Ben Bernanke in charge of the money supply. Last year, he increased the money supply at rates that had never been seen before in the history of the Federal Reserve.
Right.
And he just as quickly put on the brakes. So he's veering from one side of the road to the other. He's slamming his foot down on the accelerator, then he's slamming his foot down on the brakes, and it just can't be done. You know, I mean, you can't create any sort of economic progress when you build in that sort of monetary instability. It just can't be done. So lately, he's been crashing. It appears he's been crashing the dollar supply. The performance of the dollar index doesn't indicate that he's been crashing it as much as some statistics would suggest. But at some point, you and I both know he's going to resort to more inflation. He's going to veer off to that side of the road. He's going to hit the brakes. Now that he's hit the brakes, he's going to slam down on the accelerator again.
And then what happens to interest rates in the housing market?
Well, you know, I can't get over in the housing market the primary trend. You had a huge peak in the housing market in 2006, and it's going
to
take another 10 years
to
reach the bottom of that.
Right.
So, you know, one of the things that's really disconcerting about trying to listen to news on the radio or TV is that these people see one little sparrow and say, oh, well, the spring is here now. Well, the spring is not here now, and that sparrow is molting anyway.
Right.
So things take time to work themselves out, and that's the reason why we have to make up our mind about what the long term is, make a strategy for the long term, and then we have to be sure enough of our research and our decision to stick with it when it appears that we may be wrong.
Well, that's a very good question, because one of the things I was thinking is if you look at the numbers of what happened last year or what happened for the last couple of years or the last decade, it's very much in alignment with what is basically simple things that you and I have been saying, which is we're going through a long-term shift from a bull market in financial assets to tangibles.
Mm-hmm.
We have to reconcile the funny paper with the real economy, and, you know, and we're going to have to deal with the economics of the baby boomer generation, and those things are all connected to each other, and we're in a long-term bull market for precious metals. And if you look at the numbers, that's exactly what happened. At the same time, if you live through the year and the volatility of it and all of the different discussions and debates from all sides, it wasn't, you know, you're dealing with tremendous volatility of thinking, tremendous volatility of concerns and points of view, and then tremendous volatility in the prices of everything, both in the dollars and other fiat currencies.
You know, the only word that really describes it is schizophrenia. I don't know how else you describe it, because at one moment there's nothing but huge economic optimism, and then the next moment there's this pessimism. And unless you have some grounding in yourself and some root, then you're going to be sucked in by all of these.
Well, but I've never figured out a system to tell somebody how to kind of see through it to the long-term trends and not sweat the short-term stuff.
You know what I learned from Richard Russell? I don't know if you know who
Richard is. Oh, I love Richard. Have you seen his latest commentary?
No.
Oh, it's one of the best on gold in the market.
Well, he's a fabulous fellow, but there's one thing I learned from him, and that is the fundamental principle of investing is always stick with the primary trend.
Right.
Now, that's hard to do sometimes because, you know, the primary trend is a perspective of 20 years, and we don't live in that. We live in the day-to-day. But based on that principle, back in 2001, I wrote a book, and I said, look, there's several things you've got to do. You've got to get out of dollars, get out of stocks, get into gold and silver and productive assets. And it's, you know, it's now 9 years later, and there's not a word of that I would change. But I've been pretty nervous about it at several times in the last 9 years.
Right. Now, but if you look at that switch, if you look at, for example, putting, it's relatively easy to put your money in gold and silver.
Uh-huh.
You know, you've got a lot to learn, and you know, so I'm not going to say it's the simplest thing in the world, but if you look at switching your money to productive assets, you know, I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to build a local food supply. It's not a simple thing. It takes time. You know, it's a year. It's many years of sort of learning and process, and you need your time on the implementation. You don't need your time watching, you know, living in mucky mind and watching everything go up and down.
No, I think that's one reason you ought to stop reading newspapers.
I don't disagree, but I think the trick, this is like the, remember that, you know, that game show where the game was, if you could not turn around and look at what the noise was, you know, and but this is like, you know, the question is, can we stay focused on implementing the primary trends and not lose our time and attention to the game?
Right. Right.
So, now speaking, I did want to ask, we have a question that we've talked about before, but you had said in the fall, you know, if we really saw gold swoon, it could go down to 650. And I thought we should just discuss, you know, could that happen?
I don't think that, from a technical standpoint, that's really not possible anymore. What is possible, and barely possible, is a decline to 950. That could happen. I'm not looking for that. What I think that's happened is that we made that peak in December. We came down to about 1085 on gold and 1680 on silver, and we did that in the week between Christmas and New Year's. I think that's the bottom of it. That satisfies at least two technical targets that I had. And so if we don't see those lows violated, what we're going to see is gold and silver gradually gaining. They'll go sideways, but always drifting just a little bit higher. This may take, you know, it may take a month. We may have a sudden rally like we had last year when in 35 days gold made huge gains and silver did too. Or it may take 3 or 4 months. Seasonally, what we're looking at is that they're quite often highs in February, March, and highs in May. So seasonally, we could see gold go to, say, 1,600 by May. And that may not happen. You know, I mean, seasonal patterns are averages, and so you don't know exactly what will come of that. But my guess is probably that gold will end the year probably above 1,600, but certainly above 1,300, and silver somewhere over $25. And I think those are reasonable.
So silver's going to have a better year.
Oh, certainly, yeah.
Yeah.
We're going to get I think that in the first half of this year, we're going to get an opportunity to make a swap, a gold-silver swap at a ratio of 47 to 1.
Wow!
Oh, yeah. It'll be good. But right now it's at 61, you know, but that can happen very, very suddenly.
Suddenly. That's true.
So, but I think the main thing is, recurring to those fundamental principles and primary trends, you know and I know the government is in a trap. They set up an entire institutional system that is biased towards inflation. So we know that regardless of what they say and regardless of even of what they do for short periods of time, they're going to go back to inflation. You know,
right.
The hog goes back to wallowing in the mire. There's no other way around it. They're a hog. You know?
Right. Well, it's one way to deal with the debt.
Right.
Right.
It's the only way to deal with the debt.
Well, they could do a radical devaluation.
Well.
You know, we could wake up tomorrow and gold could be at 3,500 and the government, you know, courtesy of the government.
Well, but, you know, those radical devaluations, if you're in Colombia, you can get away with that, or Venezuela.
Right.
But when you're in the biggest economy in the world and you are the world's reserve currency, it's not quite as easy to do.
Right. We have a little bit more guns than the citizens in North Korea. A few more. One of the questions we got was, do you think the dollar will collapse?
Well, I really think that on your side there, that is on the side of stability, is the entire institutional setup. The Fed's goal is to maintain the dollar's existence, period, and as much stability as they could muster. And everybody in the Treasury Department is focused on the same thing. So the last thing they want to see is a catastrophic situation where all the balls are thrown up in the air, the dollar spontaneously self-combusts, so to speak, in a hyperinflation, and nobody knows who's in charge anymore. So they're going to try very hard not to let that happen. The thing is, though, that there's a great deal of arrogance. These people are arrogant. They don't even have the humility that central bankers from, say, the 1940s to the 1980 had, you know, when they knew they were dealing with cosmic forces of the universe and they better be careful.
Right.
People, I just get the feeling people like Bernanke, Geithner, these are intellectual lightweights and they're...
Well, but they've never, you know, they've always, they're young, relatively.
Right.
They weren't part of doing it. Never forget one of my former partners from Dillon Reed coming and speaking at him, come speak to Hamilton Securities in 96, and he described the group that was leading the governing committee at the New York Stock Exchange, and he pointed out that none of them had ever lived in a down market.
Right.
They didn't know.
Right. And that's exactly the problem with it, with so-called investment advisors and financial advisors today.
Right.
You know, they were 6 years old when the bull market in stocks started.
Right.
And at the same time, there was a bear market in silver and gold, and so they've never known anything else. They can't imagine anything else. And this is, these people, a lot of these people in government think that they're masters of the universe, and unfortunately, they're just pygmies.
Right. That's why I love talking to people who've lived through different experiences.
Right.
You know, in other countries. When I was in Estonia and talking with them about what it was like to have your currency collapse. And the more you can read and look at, you know, stories of people who've lived through it, the one thing I would say is the dollar's going to collapse. It's just going to collapse in slow motion.
Right.
And if you look at the cost to you and I of that collapse happening, whether it's in the dollar or if it's in another fiat currency, because the dynamic is going to be similar globally for many, many currencies. You know, the things that we would do in a collapse, we can do anyway, and we need to protect ourselves. I know at dinner, Franklin and I were just working on, we have a new version coming out this year of the silverandgoldormoney.com calculator, and we've been working on converting it into an iPhone app that we're very excited about. But it, you know, essentially it's designed so that people in a community can start, they have a calculator, we'll have currencies, lots of currencies in addition to the U.S. currency. And so you'll be able to get the spot price in your currency, and you'll be able to, you know, literally to walk around a community and pay each other with silver.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, if it's an expensive item with gold and silver, and just calculate it on a cell phone or an iPhone. It's very exciting. And but I think those things are going to happen. The person who asked the question mentioned Barter. I think we can't wait for a collapse to kind of start doing these things, because even if it's a slow motion change, it's going to drain us financially if we don't start to convert how we exchange goods and services among ourselves.
Well, I think it's the difference between being proactive and reactive.
Right.
You know, to be reactive is to read all the stories about coming disasters and brace yourself for that, as opposed to saying, come disaster, I want to see it, because I want to take away the system that exists now and set up something that works.
Right, so look at what's going to happen as an opportunity. So
right.
Where's the opportunity in it? So now I'm going to give you a chance to say something nice about the Federal Reserve. I'm going to ask you if you could recommend a primer on banking. You know, it's funny, because I've looked for primers, and I can't find sort of one general one that I like.
Mm-hmm.
So I just asked you this question tonight, so I'm gonna turn this one over to you.
Well, believe it or not, the Chicago Fed published, probably 30 years ago, a little booklet called Modern Money Mechanics, and it might be 40 pages long. And it's very candid. It's amazingly candid. You know, I mean, they admit that there's nothing behind the money, and they admit how the whole thing works. But it's Modern Money Mechanics, and it's probably downloadable off the Chicago Fed's website.
Yeah. There's another great question I just was going to ask you quickly, not on the subject of money, but on health. It is as follows. Medical and health facts are best confirmed through reliable sources. What are some of the best sources? I know you rely on Weston Foundation, your practitioner in Franklin, other web-based sources. And the reason I wanted to ask you this, Franklin, is you You have a wonderful compendium of all the Money Changer Health stories and interviews.
Mm-hmm.
Is that still available?
It is. I think it's for sale at my website, but if it's not, they can our listeners can just email me and I.
And what can what is it called?
It's I think it's called the Money Changer Guide to Alternative Health, and it's 25 years of conversations and interviews with people who are in the alternative health field. Some of them way out there, some of them not so far out there. One of the ones that I like the best is, of course, Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez and his cancer therapy that it works for about 68% of the patients who present themselves to him. And there's no radiation, there's no chemotherapy. It's just strictly diet and cleansing regimens and supplements. But, you know, I guess, Catherine, I've kind of collected these people over the years. You know, I just hear about them and run them down. And a lot of them are people who are not very vocal about what they're doing.
And the good ones tend to be very, very quiet and careful.
Right, and they don't make outrageous claims about what they do. And probably that's a good thing. I'm not saying that they're frightened, but you know and I know that the greatest crime that you can commit in the United States today, the one that is most sure to get you indicted, is not stealing millions of dollars from a bank. It's curing cancer.
Right.
And, well, you know Stan Poston, he's a
uh-huh.
member of our community. He was diagnosed with glioblastoma in October. He was operated on for it, and he elected for alternative therapy, and he had a PET scan about 7 or 8 days ago, and as far as the doctor who read it could tell, the cancer is now inactive. And
right.
If you know about glioblastoma, the survival rates are very, very poor.
Well, but it doesn't surprise me. I just put up on a blog review I did of Suzanne Summers' book, Knockout,
mm-hmm.
and she interviews two people that you've introduced me to, or their work,
mm-hmm.
and that's Dr. Jonathan Wright at the Tahoma Clinic and Dr. Gonzalez, who you just described.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it's funny because her book really reminded me of the Money Changer collection of interviews, because she goes around and interviews all these doctors.
Well, Jonathan Wright is one of those that I would very much follow. Bruce West is another, and especially if you have heart problems, Bruce West is very good on those. And then there's another fellow who publishes a letter, Dr. Robert Rowen, and R-O-W-E-N, and he's very good too. But the dean of all of the nutritional doctors is unquestionably Jonathan Wright.
Well, there's a lot of great sources for healthcare. And interestingly enough, the one thing I would add is you can see the health websites that I use on my blog. There's a link under healthcare, and one is Better Health Guide. But what I found is a group of people who've tried to heal themselves from Lyme disease or chronic fatigue, and they are just encyclopedias of knowledge on the health. And, you know, and I get a lot of great ideas from them. So
let me throw somebody else out here, too. I would recommend that everybody read a book by Dr. John Sarno, S-A-R-N-O, called The Mind-Body Connection.
Oh, that's great.
Sarno has found that in cases of chronic pain and chronic disease, that about 80% of them respond to his treatment. And his argument is that when you face in your life a stress that is too great to be faced, what your body does is make you sick as a diversion from that stress, from having to face that stress. Now, that's not to say that you ain't really sick, you're just thinking, you just think you are, because the pain is real.
Right.
It really makes you, your body really, your mind really makes you ill. But Sarno has a method for dealing with that, and it's easy to dismiss that as a bunch of talk, but until you've talked to people, I have a friend who was a chiropractor who was absolutely disabled for 10 years. He found Sarno's work. He went through Sarno's recommended program, and he is now back practicing. He is no longer disabled. He has no health problems at all.
Well, you know, that exact thing that you just described where you can't deal with it, so you get sick. That happened to me driving over here when You know, wonderful intern David Lichty was reading to me. We were reviewing all the policy proposals on 401ks and IRAs. I literally had to stop. And, you know, I never drink coffee in the afternoon. I had to get coffee. And I said, I know I shouldn't do this, but I just, it's so evil. I get so upset. Anyway, so maybe if we could turn to we've now seen, and it was really funny, it was the year ended, and suddenly it was as though somebody had rung the bell. The Investment Institute comes out with a study saying, oh, 70% of Americans do not want their 401ks converted to annuities. And, you know, and we all said, what's this about? To discover that a fellow who'd been overworking for the Hamilton Project at Brookings, Robert Rubin on the advisory team, studying retirement plans and sort of retirement proposals, had come up with two studies, one being the article he did at Brookings, and you can link from the different things I've put up on the blog, basically proposes, Franklin, that all the companies in America that don't have 401ks would now be mandated to make an employee retirement plan option. It'd be mandatory that they have to offer it. The employee can technically opt out of it. And the theory is that this will get Americans to save more. And what is not described, and sort of the idea is Americans need more money for their retirement, so this is a way to get them to act responsibly, and as a result, there'll be more money available for retirement. They'll save more. And there's absolutely no mention of the fact that, in essence, what you're forcing, what this really is forcing small businesses to pool capital from their employees in a way that will finance large corporations that will then continue to come into their communities and take over their markets.
Right.
So you're literally being mandated to finance your enemy. Now, it doesn't have to go down that way. You know, if everybody would get together and figure out how we could start doing, I don't want to beat the drum too hard for community venture funds. And, you know, but there are lots of ways. If we're going to argue about 10th Amendment, I think we ought to start arguing about how we pool capital and make it attractive to stay locally. So there are options. But behind this is a huge economic warfare engineering that says we're going to continue to skim the small guys to finance the big guys. And it's pretty ugly. And then, so that's one. But the second is one that I can't swear I really understand. But what it's saying is that when people start to withdraw from their 401ks and IRAs, which they're scheduled to do, you know, as the boomers turn 59 plus, as they start to withdraw, instead of getting the money in a lump sum, in fact, it will be converted into an annuity. So let's say somebody took $10,000 out of their IRA. Instead of getting $10,000, in fact, they get a $10,000 annuity that would then pay them monthly. Now, of course, to me and you, this is nothing but confiscation, but my favorite comment came from Jesse at the Cafe Americana, who said, oh, now that interest rates are down to nothing, we're going to put people in the equivalent of a long bond at a low interest rate. I can't think of anything that would lose their money faster. So you're essentially forcing people's capital into that thing which is sure to go down. It's quite amazing.
Well, exactly. And, you know, whether the point here is to figure out some way to trap that money in Wall Street and not allow people to take it out, or what is more likely, that it's a way to force the American people to finance government deficits, what they're doing is trapping everybody in inflation. They're not giving you any alternative at all to protect yourself. They're going to keep your money trapped in that IRA. And this goes back to something that I learned. I'll give James Turk credit for 15, 18 years ago. He said, don't worry about gold confiscation. They won't do that because that's not where the money is today.
Right.
Today, the money is in 401ks and IRAs. And now we're at that point. We're not quite at that point yet, but we're certainly approaching it, because this is the second trial balloon like this, Catherine, that's been floated. They are going after that IRA and 401k money. They're going to lock it up some way so that you won't have control of it. And this has always been my objection to IRAs and 401ks, namely that you have title but you don't have control. So people are going to have to make up their minds very, very quickly. Am I going to leave my money in an IRA and basically have the whole thing confiscated, or am I going to take the money out now and do with it whatever I can, pay the penalty, pay the tax, forget about that.
Right, or depending on the tax considerations, because it can throw your rates up to higher brackets. So, you know, some people may also decide to withdraw in stages.
Right. Well, however they do it, they're going to have to ask themselves the question, do I want to be satisfied with a large part of what I put in, or do I want to be satisfied with little bitty teaspoonfuls sometime in the future?
Well, what's going to happen this year, and it's all part of this rush hour cometh, you have the pig trying to go through the snake. And the pig can't fit through the snake, so something's got to give. And I think what you're watching at the root is a repricing of control. And a realization by many people who've allowed themselves to be financially intermediated, you know, I've got to disintermediate. I've got to get out. I've got to, and I think that's going to be part of the shift to tangibles.
Well, I love your word disintermediation. It's one of my favorites. But the way I put it is, I'm going to take control of my own existence.
Right.
I'm going to take it out of the hands of the people who've proven themselves untrustworthy to manage my affairs, and I'm going to manage it myself. So, and I think that's what we have to do, and that is, of course, a disintermediation.
It's the ultimate.
Yeah, you bet.
One of the last questions we got, which I think is really, so to sort of close out on 401k and IRA, I think this round is more serious than last year. You know, they started to trial balloon, and the thing that scares me about this one, Franklin, is that the Investment Institute had already performed a study.
Right.
So they've been working and preparing to beat this back and make sure it runs through Wall Street and the financial institutions. And so this is going to be a serious discussion. And if you look at the numbers on financing the deficit, at some point it's going to be hard for the leadership to force China to finance it if they won't force Americans to finance it.
Right.
So the politics here are getting meaner, and it's making me much more nervous than I was last year. Last question I wanted to ask, can the government get to foreign accounts like old money? What is your sense of the danger of the government trying to freeze or seize foreign accounts like old money? Are we safe storing gold abroad? I would say that there are benefits to storing abroad and benefits to having it under your own control, and it's really a balance between them. The important thing to understand about any financial institution, literally globally, is the American government has jurisdiction. So we're going to watch the financial services reform bill go through Congress this year. One of the things I'm going to be watching is how many more draconian provisions are they adding to financial institutions, including foreign financial institutions, and again, what does that do to our ability to control our money, whether it's whether it's in Switzerland or Timbuktu or, right next door. But these kinds of controls are increasing, and they're going to keep increasing. And I think it's all part of this fundamental repricing of control. And so having control is going to be more and more valuable than it has been in the past. Okay, well, Franklin, why don't you just join us for a second? We're just going to touch on Shut Up and Sing. It's a wonderful documentary, and I hope you all got to see it. If you didn't, though, I've put it, you can get it through YouTube. I put it up on the blog post. It's the story of the Dixie Chicks, who was a trio from Texas of women who were, for many years, the most popular, sold the most records, number one CD-selling band in the country. It was a country music group. And in 2004, they were in London on tour. At the same time, there was an enormous protest of the American invasion of Iraq. I think I had a friend who was an investment manager who was in the group that turned out, who said it was, I believe, more than a million people. It was quite an extraordinary turnout. And the lead singer at the time said that she was ashamed that the president was from Texas, where the Dixie Chicks are from. And it was picked up by The Guardian and then picked up by the U.S. press and turned into quite a storm. And a real effort was made sort of by the corporate machinery to encourage people to not listen to the Dixie Chicks. The machine really turned on them, and they had quite a drop off in their sales, quite a drop off in their following. They continued to tour, and then after the tour was over, wrote a new record about sort of their experience. It's really the artists, sort of how they felt about the whole thing, and very beautiful music. Came out with a new CD, I think it was about 2 years later, and it went to number one, just phenomenal performance, and it went outside the country space, so it really broadened them. They went on tour again and did nowhere near as well. They were still fighting the machinery. And I wanted to watch it. I wanted you to watch it because it says a couple of very extraordinary things. One, it tells the story of what can happen to someone when the machinery turns on them. And there's a very sort of interesting point about two-thirds into the documentary where you have President Bush and some other people saying, well, if celebrities say anything about politics, it's going to hurt their cash flow, and the lesson is they shouldn't get involved in politics. And you literally feel a chill of, sort of the machinery saying, look, this is our business, and you guys better just shut up and sing. And another thing you see is the extraordinary, this is a group of people who had been playing together and known each other for a long time. And what was very interesting is that they held together as a group of people and took the position that sort of their friendship and their career together was more important than anything else. And there was no backbiting or attacking. It was it's a wonderful example of a creative artist response and of a real human decency and loyalty within a team of people. You see in the documentary how concerned they are about the people who are about to go on tour with them and the economic risks to all of them and how this could hurt them. And so you see the risks that are managed by people who dare to comment on the machinery. There's a very interesting moment when they go back to London with a new on the new tour in 2007, and the lead singer repeats her comment of 2004. Took a lot of courage to do. And of course, now that we know everything has come out, that the U.S.'s, what the administration had used to justify the war, has been pretty much shown to be a bunch of bunk. So by the time they got back to London, the polls and things had changed. But you really see the challenge and the extent to which the machinery can swing the crowd one way or another, and it's a very very sobering experience to watch or to participate. When the reference Shut Up and Sing comes from a death threat that they received, and you watch them go into concert in Dallas very much concerned that somebody might try and take their life and the stress that causes them and their family. Anyway, Shut Up and Sing, it's a very interesting documentary. It's produced by the same producer who produces Michael Moore's movies. Generally, if you look at anything that comes from that side of the house, they pretty much focus on things that make the Republicans look bad. So you don't get the full bipartisan picture of the system, but you certainly see there's plenty of reasons to criticize the Republicans, and you certainly see some of them in it. So Shut Up and Sing, I recommend it to you. In closing, a couple things. We're next week, I'm really looking forward to, and it's thanks to Franklin that I found out about him, is we're going to have Who's Your Sheriff with Richard Mack. Richard Mack is the Arizona sheriff who sued the federal government when they mandated that local sheriffs enforce the Brady Law. He took the federal government to the Supreme Court along with some additional sheriffs, including one from Montana, and won. And that's because, again, if you read the Constitution, you understand the federal government does not have the power to mandate a local sheriff to do anything, particularly anything that is outside of the federal government's jurisdiction under the Constitution. And so as we come into a year and a period when state and local governments may be asserting 10th Amendment rights, there's no more critical discussion of then who's your sheriff. We've got a great question from one of our subscribers. How do you know if you have a good sheriff? That's a great question, because I've tried to figure it out. It's not so easy to do. So we're going to be asking Richard Mack that question, and I hope you will. I hope you'll post other questions. I will say this year, if you want to look at what's an election in your county and in your life that's really important, the sheriff's race this year is probably going to be more important than any other election in your county if you look at the powers and the issues under the 10th Amendment. Just remember, if somebody comes to confiscate your gold or confiscate your possessions, they can't do it if your sheriff says no. He has jurisdiction within his area. So who's your sheriff on January 22nd? Then in the first week of February, we're going to have the Layman's Guide to Mind Control. And I bring that up now because we're going to be talking about two movies. They're fabulous movies if you want to understand mind control. Hollywood has really sort of laid out the map on mind control. I want you to watch Telephone with Charles Bronson. It's a late 70s movie about Russian spies using mind control. Telephone, T-E-L-E-F-O-N. You can get it from Netflix. If you get it from the local video store, you may have to order it. And then Manchurian Candidate, not the original one with Frank Sinatra, but the 2004 production with Denzel Washington. So it's very unusual that we have two movies, but for mind control, Hollywood has done a great job. So until next week, you're in my prayers. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.